Remember when the American dream comprised 2.4 children, a couple of nice vehicles, and most importantly, a house with a manicured lawn encircled by a white picket fence? Now, I don't know about the kids or the cars, but these days, a large and growing segment of the American public would be hard-pressed to afford the picket fence, much less the house. Worse still, a hefty percentage of those who do take the leap into home ownership end up getting impaled, financially speaking, on that fence that once seemed so alluring. Hi, I'm John Schwannis, and on this week's show, we'll bring home the issue of affordable housing in Indiana, or more accurately, the lack thereof. What's the problem? Post-pandemic inflation, inadequate public infrastructure, burdensome regulation, labor shortages, soaring mortgage rates. Short answer, yes. Indiana lawmakers, from the State House to your house, if you're lucky enough to have one. You don't have to look hard to find evidence of a housing crisis here in Indiana or across the country. According to Pew Research, roughly half of all Americans report that a shortage of affordable housing is a major problem where they live. And more than two-thirds say today's young adults are far less able than their parents' generation to buy a home. Now, things are even worse for renters, especially those stuck on the lower rungs of the economic ladder. A report from Prosperity Indiana suggests that 61% of Hoosiers in low-income households spend more than half of their income on rent, leaving little for food and other necessities. Joining me to talk about what can be done to improve the situation are Republican Representative Doug Miller of Elkhart, co-chair of the Indiana Housing Task Force, which issued 16 recommendations prior to this year's session; Democratic Senator Eddie Melton of Gary, who has made affordable, sustainable housing a cornerstone of his current campaign for mayor in his hometown; Jake Sipe, executive director of the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, which works with developers, lenders, investors, and nonprofits to aid low and moderate income Hoosiers; and Rick Wajda, chief executive officer of the Indiana Builders Association, a statewide trade group representing some 3,000 home builders and remodelers. Thank you all for being here. Doug Miller, let me start with you. We talked about the task force, which you co-chaired. The first meeting back, I think it was in September of last year, you made a comment that's got a lot of attention, and it was pretty profound. And I think I'm quoting you directly when I say it was, affordable housing is no longer affordable.
Yeah, it's a true statement.
Elaborate on that. What do you mean, and how did we get there?
So we were actually at a confluence of a lot of different events, right? So over the course of time, especially since 2000, we've seen workforce shrink. We've seen a banking crisis that actually housing got trapped in the middle. We've seen income growth stagnate to some point, and we've also seen the cost of literally everything that we want to purchase as consumers go up. So it has literally stretched the budget of every American, and specifically Hoosiers. And so what we were tasked to do is take a look at, if communities and the development community work together, how could we start filling a niche that has literally been priced out of the market for a long time?
And when you talked about this confluence or convergence of events, you talked about a lot of national issues, workforce, changes in the workforce, inflationary pressures, et cetera, et cetera. And those are all either global issues or national issues. Is Indiana better off or worse off than a lot of other states, in your opinion?
Well, honestly, that's one reason that I was thrilled to be able to be a co-chair along with Senator Rogers of the task force, and have other members of the General Assembly and members from the public and the private sector on the task force. I think Indiana is a great place to be able to face the problem head on. We're growing our jobs at a phenomenal rate. We're having outside investment come in and make permanent homes from a job standpoint, from a business and industry standpoint, at a phenomenal rate. Our quality of life, our quality of place is developing faster than many states around us. We virtually lead the Midwest at a large number of categories, but that doesn't make us immune from the problem, right? It just says we have more resources available to us to address the problem.
Eddie Melton, you know, Elkhart and Gary, if you look at a map, they're not that far. You can make a relatively easy drive, but they could be light years apart in terms of the challenges they face with, right, with their workforce growth, with various economic factors. From your perspective, do you see that Indiana has a housing crisis? And what, if so, what does it mean from your perspective?
Yeah, I believe so. I think from my perspective, coming from the northwest part of the state, I've seen various forms of housing inequities in terms of a lot of a blight and making sure that we have more infill housing. But if you look at just Gary alone and our population, we at our height had about 175,000 people. And most recent census said we have 69,000 residents. So making sure that we can have complementary options and opportunities for seniors, for student housing. We have Indiana University Northwest in our own backyard. So trying to be more diverse in our options and provide that for individuals that's looking to stay, because we have to retain our population, but also to recruit individuals, being very close to Chicago. And we look at our opportunities with transit-oriented development, with the South Shore line that the legislature passed in 2017. I think we have a unique opportunity to really build off a lot of success.
Of course, you raise an interesting point, again, how it's a departure from Elkhart, which may simply need more housing stock. You point out that as this the population in your hometown has shrunk, yes, some of the houses have been raised or disappeared, but there's still a lot of vacant or blighted properties. So is the answer, and I guess this gets into your mayoral campaign, about building new or just somehow figuring out a way to resurrect existing housing stock?
Well, I think it's a mixture of both, right? I know that currently right now we have over 6,000 abandoned homes. Many of them are in a position to be demolished. But we also know that during the pandemic, a lot of residents invested their own dollars on the tax sale, purchasing these properties and rehabbing them and putting them back on the tax roll, either as rental properties or whatever. So I think that's going to be a combination. But when we look at the large swaths of land that we have, the City of Gary, the Gary Housing Authority, the Gary School Corporation are the largest landholders in the city, and they haven't been working collaboratively. I'm encouraging a study collectively to figure out how do we best use this land, and looking at housing as one of those elements.
You know, Jake Sipe, you've been at this in this business, what, a couple decades now in your role. So you've seen the change. You saw the days before this convergence or confluence of events that Representative Miller alluded to, perhaps. So I'm interested in your take on what has spelled the current situation. And also, you know, there's so many statistics that we could all toss out here, and a lot of them just become numbing. But you all have cited one that seems to have resonated with a lot of people, and that is for individuals or living in households with under $50,000 annual income, just to get to where we need to be as a state, your estimate is 420,000 new units, which is a lot of units.
It is a lot of units, but it's also, we also have to understand that in our state, we have an aging housing stock. 45% of our housing stock in our state was built prior to 1970. So we also need to think about not only creating new housing, but preserving our existing housing stock. And that goes for both home ownership and rental.
Which is cheap? I mean, is one materially better economically than the other?
They're
now
both,
you've got asbestos, potentially lead, if it was built at a certain time. Does that make it cost prohibitive, and is it just better to raise it and build something new?
No, I think preserving our existing, because we have a tremendous volume of existing affordable rental housing that we need to continue to invest in to preserve.
Well, where is that, though? I mean, apparently it's anywhere anybody needs it to be.
Well, the need is that we continue to create jobs, and however, our housing is not producing and keeping pace with those job creations. So we're, for every 100 jobs created, we're creating about 45 new units. That pace, compounding annually over the last 10 years, has really created this widening of gap that we need to fill in terms of new homes. But we also can't lose focus on the need to preserve our existing housing as well.
So it's all of the above is the answer. Your organization should be smiling, I would think. I mean, the demand is there. People want houses. The only struggle is you're not motivating people to want to still own homes. It's just helping them get from point A to point B financially. What dog do you have in this in terms of the builders, 3,000 members?
Sure.
Why isn't everybody smiling?
Yeah, John, I mean, it's a great point, right? And roughly 3,000 members across the state of Indiana, but that number was over 7,000 member companies across the state
of
Indiana.
Well, there's the most telling statistic,
I guess. The early 2000s, right? So the contraction of the industry in the last great recession in the mid-2000s, a lot of builders, a lot of suppliers, subcontractors left the business, and haven't came back, right? Due to retiring out, aging out of the workforce, or they moved into a different occupation, and you know, we haven't seen those numbers come back. And there's been some consolidation, and so you know, early to mid 2000s, there was 30 plus thousand single family houses built in the state of Indiana every year. That number dropped to under 10,000 coming out of the recession, and we were just getting back to a number that was sustainable in Indiana. We expect a healthy housing market is about 18 to 22,000 single family houses being built every year. And so we spent a decade plus of not meeting current demand. And then you finally get to a point and the pandemic hits, right? And now we're, you know, coming out of the pandemic and things have slowed because mortgage rates have more than doubled in the last year plus, right? So it's squeezing out a lot of potential Hoosiers from being able to qualify for a mortgage and build that house.
Well, given the reduction from 7,000 to 3,000, that does suggest that there's been a contraction. So in light of that, what is the guarantee that if everything else, all the reforms were enacted and the money were to flow and people who didn't have access to homes ownership before might now see the door of opportunity open, are you even capable, your industry, of erecting these homes? Or is that another issue that might have to be dealt with? Are there simply enough people, skilled craftspeople, to put these things up?
John, that's a great question, right? And we're hopeful that the demand and the workforce will be there to be able to supply the housing that is needed in the state of Indiana. We have challenges just like every other state across the country, right? As the baby boomer population is aging out of the workforce, and do we have enough workers to come back in on the front end to build houses, to build sewer, water infrastructure, roads? There's going to be competition at every occupation level, and we think that if we can show that young worker in the state of Indiana that there's opportunity long term to build your career, that the workers will come. And frankly, we're going to have to look to states around us in the Midwest and on the coast and say, hey, Indiana is a good place to come and live and work, and look what our government is doing to provide those opportunities, and we think we'll be successful.
And it might mean paying those workers more to lure them here, which in turn raises prices on those newly affordable homes. So I guess it's another challenge. It's always sort of a cyclical issue here. Now, your caucus, Republicans, who currently have a supermajority both in the House and the Senate, I didn't need to remind you of that, did I, Senator? you know, the talk is often about small government, market forces, you know, that's what made America. We don't pick winners and losers. We often hear that. Why don't I just say, hey, the economy is going to fix all this. Market forces will fix it. You know, the builders will rush to meet demand if it's really there. What's wrong with that theory on this issue?
So this, we talk about that often, right? So the task force looked at how does the market solve the problem, right? And if you look at the recommendations that came out of the task force, the recommendations actually centered around government getting in the way of letting the market drive the solutions to the problem. So the task force recommendations, and actually 1005, have provisions in it that encourage local units of government to have discussions about zoning, about allowing accessory dwelling units, about modifying current zoning to allow manufactured and modular housing. Those are actually
so more affordable housing and more of it in the same
right
land.
And relaxing other developmental standards to drive to pull those costs down. A for instance would be that 3 years ago, while working on legislation designing at moving architectural standards aside, or at least encouraging discussions to happen locally, one of our communities around the donuts decided that they would make it mandatory to put 4 inches of black dirt over the entire property on new construction, and it raised the price of the actual project under construction by $5,000. National Home Builders for the state of Indiana has produced data that for every $1,000 you raise or lower the price of a home, it takes 3,200 buyers out of the market. So you can see how price sensitive the market is. And so really, 1005 and the provisions and the guidelines that are in it, right, is designed to encourage those discussions at the local level. And to Senator Melton's point, when he looks at Gary and says we're rehabbing, as a mayor, if he gets really creative, it's a great opportunity for him to not only rebuild his infrastructure, but to help rehab some of those properties that he's talking about.
Of course, it's not all about getting government out of the way. If you look at those 16 recommendations, I don't have to remind you, some of them were pleading to government to get more involved in terms of creating seed money or revolving loan fund, or, for instance, incentivizing taxpayers and giving them more governmental inducements to do it. So I guess it's cut breaks one way or the other.
I would say yes, but we have to look at the fact that it's a revolving loan fund. This is not a handout by any stretch. Those monies are going to be paid back. They're going to be reinvested. And the
idea is community could help put in infrastructure and sidewalks,
correct,
and all that what a builder might have had to absorb,
correct,
before.
Correct. And it's a long-term investment in Indiana. This isn't a one-shot deal. This is a long-term plan to provide for sustainable growth to help meet a demand that has accumulated over the last 20 years.
Eddie Melton, is government the problem or the solution?
Well, I don't think it's a problem. I think it's an opportunity that we must seize upon right now. So we look at the state of Indiana and our strong fiscal state, right? We just had the fiscal forecast that came out yesterday. We're going to be in a very strong position again, as usual. But as other states see that growth and that opportunity, we have to start telling our story around the country and making sure that we let folks know that we're in a good position. And I constantly say that, especially for my part of the state, because we know that the taxes in the Chicagoland area are extremely high. Folks have been relocating into Gary and Northwest Indiana, looking for opportunities, want to be around the lakefront and seizing those opportunities. But if we don't collectively as a state tell our story, and just not Central Indiana, no offense to Central Indiana folks, but as Northwest Indiana and Northeast Indiana, as I'm sure they're looking to say, how do we tell our story to Illinois and to Michigan and Ohio area to say, come take a look, a strong look. Our economy is strong. As we work to build our workforce, this is a good opportunity for you.
I did read somewhere that you get outside the donut counties and the land actually keeps going. The earth doesn't just fall off there. But I do get around. Not everybody does. You know, Jake Syke, what's the answer here? I mean, you have the finance authority certainly is sort of the fiscal oil in the machinery, or maybe the catalyst. But I mean, what's the one thing you'd love to see come out of this session that would really make a difference?
Well, I'm proud that we're going to have a revolving loan fund, because it is important that we continue to invest in our state in housing, specifically also for providing housing opportunities for our low and moderate working families, and also individuals who may have a disability or an intellectual disability. So we need to ensure that we have that stable housing that's safe and affordable for our workforce, but also for some of our most vulnerable population.
And that loan fund, the way it's set up, it's not Indianapolis-centric,
right?
To flip your argument. I mean, it's 70% of it would go to communities with populations of fewer than 50,000 people. And presumably, since your focus has been low and moderate income individuals, you're talking about multifamily dwellings almost by definition.
For the most part, I think a balanced approach of rental and housing home ownership. Our agency does provide down payment assistance for first-time home buyers. And in fact, last year we did almost $26 million of down payment assistance. So when we look at the workforce housing, especially that moderate income level, it is driving our housing market right now. And those are incomes that are somewhere between just over $100,000 to $75,000 a year. Those home buyers are really driving our housing market, especially on the first-time home ownership piece. Now, we need price points at those income levels, which is where we're having the challenge right now for that first-time home buyer to buy a home at $170,000 to $230,000, which are very rare when we can build them at that level. Hopefully a revolving loan fund that can reduce the carrying costs for our builders can drive those prices down and make them more affordable for our home buyers.
Go ahead, Senator.
And I want to commend Representative Miller and Senator Rogers on their work on it.
His co-chair on the task.
Exactly. In the beginning, I did have some concerns about that 50,000 mark. I didn't want it to rule out cities like Gary and other communities that may not be that first-class city, like in Indianapolis, but we still aren't that rural community with a population of 50,000 or more. I think there are some elements in it that may help moving that conversation forward. But I want to touch on something that was just mentioned in terms of the most vulnerable population, right? So in our area, we have a very aging population. We have a growing senior population, and ensuring we just very intentional about quality of life. Right now, seniors, their primary option in Northwest Indiana or in Gary is high-rise locations, and that's not compatible for their lifestyle or access to adequate transportation routes. So quality of life is extremely important if we want to talk about housing, not just for seniors, but for millennials and those that's looking to kind of ascend into a more affluent communities.
Rick, let me ask you, again, there maybe is no one panacea or silver bullet, but if we took up a collection here and bought 1,000 acres, and you're really going to give a lot of the money, 1,000 acres, right, and said, you're going to build an affordable community. I mean, what do you think is the solution?
I think bringing housing to that community at multiple price points and multiple designs.
Without government? I mean, what restrictions would you want to see? You put up any siding you want, any rich roof pitch you want?
I think you have to
No dirt, no black dirt, right.
I think you got to build the product to what the community wants. And ultimately, right, we're in the business of building homes and selling homes. So you have to bring a product to market that the consumer wants. Consumers today aren't the same as consumers 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and 30 years ago, right? The millennial generation that is moving into the home buying process right now as we speak, a lot of them, their preference is they still want to be homeowners, but they don't want large lots in a subdivision on a cul-de-sac with a half-acre lot that maybe a lot of us grew up as that was the housing choice back then. They want smaller lots. They want access to walking to amenities. They want a coffee shop or a restaurant or a grocery store where they can walk a block or two. Sounds a lot very similar to the way maybe a lot of our parents grew up in the cities, where on the corners was the grocery store or the butcher or the bakery, and then the jobs were only a couple blocks away. Now with commuting, minimized maybe to a certain extent in a lot of situations, people working from home, we're going back to maybe the way communities were built in the 50s and 60s.
Representative, is this issue done? And obviously, I think the revolving loan fund is a done deal. Some of the other measures that were designed to perhaps empower renters, especially in their relationship with unscrupulous out-of-state owners and investors and landlords, there hasn't been as much enthusiasm there, which I guess is another discussion. But is this the issue? I mean, do we take a pause after this now session, or is this just one of those things like education reform? It's just go ahead and carve out, a few committee hearings because it's going to be back again and again and again.
The broad issue of housing, I think we'll always have a discussion about it. I don't know how intense it will be moving forward. The thing that excites me the most is that there's going to be metrics built in to judge the success of the revolving grant or the revolving loan fund, right? And I think in order for the General Assembly to make good decisions moving forward, we need to be able to look at those metrics, review them, and say, yeah, this part of the process is working or this part of the process is not. With respect to other issues that exist in housing, I don't look that our work is done with respect to those.
Senator, do you sense that, we're almost out of time, but do you sense that the General Assembly, as I noted, some bills seem to go faster than others, and those that aid traditional home buyers seem to go better than those that aid renters? Is that a fair assessment? And if so, why?
Yeah, well, I think within our caucus, Senator Hunley, as well as Senator Kedora, they both had legislation to address those issues, and we did our best to try to get those bills moving. But there's one other issue I think down the road we have to talk about, especially for communities of color, is and this may be outside of the builder's conversation, but fair lending practices and making sure there's equitable opportunities for communities of color and low-income communities to have access to capital and making sure they can have that a piece of the American dream of buying that first home. We know there's been a history of redlining and a variety of other discriminatory practices, but as banks and financial institutions look to be more inclusive in their giving, I think we have to be intentional and hold them accountable.
All right, we have to leave it there. Unfortunately, time flies. I got to get a few of you aside and ask you about the shingle that won't stay on my roof, but I'll maybe get some professional advice. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate your expertise you bring to this this table and this discussion. Again, my guests have been Republican Representative Doug Miller of Elkhart, Democratic Senator Eddie Melton of Gary, Jake Sipe of the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, and Rick Wajda of the Indiana Builders Association. And time now for our weekly conversation with Indiana lawmakers analyst Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight, part of HANA News Service. Ed, what did we not talk about during the roundtable?
Oh, well, you covered a lot of things, but I think one of the things that people really need to understand is how interconnected all of this is. We've got a lot of federal money coming in for housing. You've got the state involved, you know, obviously now going forward with the House Revolving Fund. And then you also have the state involved in all kinds of regulations and things like that and telling the local governments what to do.
Suggesting,
and
they would say. Suggesting, right?
Yes. And you also have regional issues involved here because, for example, if you've got, you know, some kind of need for employment in one county and you can't afford housing there, you've got to have a way to get people to that place of employment. And that may mean mass transit. But at the local level also, you have problems with regulations as well, with, for example, requirements that homes have brick or that you dedicate as a builder a certain number of acres for public parks or certain rights of way and all that. So all kinds of different levels to this.
I think you just answered a question I asked Doug Miller about whether this takes care of it or back for another session. This will never go away.
And it's not just a legislative thing either.
Right. What else are you looking at as we approach the stretch run here?
Well, we're in conference committee deliberation time, and there are a few interesting bills that are still out there that haven't been resolved. We've got the alcohol issue that's come back up for the first time in a couple of years in a different way. We're trying to figure out whether you can sell different kinds of cold alcoholic beverages like the seltzer type things and some mixed drinks and all that in different contexts. And that's spurring another big fight within the alcohol industry. Obviously, education bills are still big out there. And then you've got different tax relief proposals. You've got proposals from House Republicans to accelerate the income tax cuts. You've got the House Republicans pushing for property tax relief, which relates to what we're talking about.
Proving your point that it's all tied together.
And in some cases, you know, local governments are looking right now, we're hearing in mayoral races of candidates saying, well, you know, we need to do something to reduce property taxes so that senior citizens can stay in our communities even after they've paid off their homes.
And any last-minute surprises, you know, we often talk about when Riverboat Gaming came into being, it sort of came out of nowhere in conference committee during a special session. Are all the cards on the table, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think, and you talked about gaming, I think one thing that you might want to watch to see if it gets stuck in that big budget bill at the end is language for an iLottery.
Ah, interesting. We'll have to leave it there. Ed, as always, appreciate your insight.
Thank you, John.
What's brewing at the State House? Well, a debate over where and how you can buy alcohol. The question over where to get a cold one is heating up on the next Indiana Lawmakers. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwannis, and on behalf of commentator Ed Feigenbaum, WFYI Public Media, and Indiana's other public broadcasting stations, I thank you for joining us, and I invite you to visit WFYI.org for more State House news. Until next week, take care.